Can I do a check for you guys?
Check. You sound great. Good.
Check, check.
All right. Yep. What were you talking about before the batteries went out?
The subparticle
hose,
thing.
The big Higgs boson.
Higgs boson. So basically, they see the paths that these particles go on because that can get read like a billionth of a second after it actually happens. But they can't because a photon is bigger than a Higgs boson, right? And so like a photon, like you can't actually take a picture of these things because a photon is like light. I don't know. It gets... Obviously, I'm confused about it.
So that altered our
space-time continuum, and that's why the world is weird.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah.
That's why J.D. Vance fucked a couch.
Allegedly.
Allegedly.
Allegedly. Where's he from again?
Ohio. Kentucky.
He fucked a couch.
He's from Kentucky?
It doesn't matter which one of you are right. He fucked a couch.
A couch, that would be the best thing he fucked.
At least it's not American democracy.
I just want to say, you know, I had a coworker from at my last job who is from Kentucky.
Yeah.
And she hates J.D. Vance. And the reason she hates J.D. Vance is because she grew up in very similar circumstances to him and is like, all of that's bullshit.
Mm.
And she has a master's in, or she has a master's in education, but her bachelor's degree is in English literature.
Yeah.
And she wrote her thesis on Hillbilly Elegy and why it's nonsense. Like that. And she's like, and then she went to school in Ohio, and then he goes and becomes one of the senators from Ohio. And when he got picked to be vice president, the VP candidate, I text her. I go, so how do you feel about your boy J.D. Vance being vice president? And she texts back, well, leave it to Trump to pick the only person I hate more than him.
Well, and so I haven't read Hillbilly Elegy, right? I haven't read it. I've heard some synopses on it, but like my general impression is that he was an arrogant prick who thought he was better than everyone he grew up around, and then he moved away and was like, I guess that's proof I'm better than them.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's like, whatever, like that exists. You can be the upper crust of society and still get that fucking asshole. You know what I mean? Like, that guy still exists at Eton in fucking Britain, you know, as much as he exists in fucking, I don't know, what's a good, like, Robert E. Lee High School in Kentucky or whatever.
Yeah. So. I mean, he was in the Marines, but he was, like, a paper pusher in the Marines.
Well, I mean, so that part I don't think is, you know, that part I don't want to...
The Marines got to push paper.
Yeah, like, you're always going to have those. I think the bigger issue is you don't want to, like, there's a difference between that and like being John F. Kennedy or Theodore Roosevelt, for instance, to take two examples of previous presidents who ran on that military experience.
John Kerry.
Well, I mean, John Kerry honestly did have that, until he got swiftboated, right? Like, until we came up with a whole new verb to describe screwing over someone.
Well, the thing that bugs me about J.D. Vance, and it's like, I don't think, like, I definitely did not grow up, like, nearly as rough as he did.
Yeah.
But he basically, the end of his book was basically like, well, they're fucking idiots, so fuck them. Mm-hmm. Like, that was the end, and you're like, so all of... Everything you learned, all of the writing you've done through this book, all of the self-reflection
that was
just ended
lesson.
In you being better than them and there's no hope for them. So I guess I'm just, you know what I mean?
Cut taxes and outsource.
Fuck them.
And it's literally, I mean, I've talked to you about this, Adam, where it's like the opium epidemic is not a part of my home community, right? Like I know people who've like gotten hooked, gotten killed. Like there was a guy like in college that I knew, like it's around and it's a whole thing. And the idea that this fucking asshole just like went through high school and like growing up and was like, yeah, I mean, I fucked the same couches as them, but like I'm smart and hardworking and they're all just a bunch of pieces of shit. Well, you know what I mean? Like it just, it
one of my favorite things that kind of popped up about him is that he was really into Garden State. He was like, did you hear, like, he was like talking about like how like it really described how I felt about going home and like not really feeling like it was home anymore. Like he like you're looking at me like you give me blank looks.
No, no, no. It's literally
he had this same emo vibes about like Garden State. Like he was on the same wavelength of that movie, which, you know, I think he's a scumbag, but I was like, you know, I kind of feel that. Yeah. You know.
I mean, but everyone's felt that. Yeah, like, everyone who's left home and come back has been like, there's good things about home and there's bad things about home. There's good things about where I'm at now and bad things about it. Like, for instance, I love D.C.
Mm-hmm.
I just recently... It's actually funny, Dr. History Scholar, because one of the last episodes I edited for us, I was making a joke about trying to buy a house in D.C.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and you're like, is this a fantasy land? I did actually afford a house in D.C. I live in a house now.
Where's the clap sound effect?
Hey, I'll find it. Nope. That's not it. Hang on. Also not it. I'm sorry. Hey. Yeah, I bought a house in D.C. All right.
You found a needle in a haystack, everybody.
Yeah, and much like being a comedian in D.C., that clap was about as fake as everybody's congratulations for me buying a house. Yay! Oh, we're so happy for you. Go fuck yourself. What was I talking about?
Yeah, you like living in D.C., but
buying like, a house. For example, the customer service here is dog shit. It's so bad compared to it. You go into Wisconsin and you're like, hey, I need this one particular product. And they're like, I'll fucking call my cousins and we'll find this for you. Like, we're going to gather around. We're going to find this product for you because you know what? You deserve it. And you're like, thank you so much. Right. In D.C., they're just like, mm-hmm.
And
that's my problem. How it reminds me of that Pop Copy sketch. Jones. Why shouldn't you help the customer? Cause fuck them. That's why. But at the same time, do you know what DC doesn't have? As much racism, not as much racism. So it's, you know, chicken or the egg. I might cut that out. Who knows? My mom will be like, there's no racism in Wisconsin.
We let the Irish in.
Yeah. Yeah. How could there be racism? We've only got the one.
You're listening to Laughing Historically with Adam Lacks, Adam Cooney, Dr. History Scholar.
Welcome to Laughing Historically. I'm your host, Adam Lacks. And the ones and twos, we got Adam Coonan.
Pew, 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 pew.
And Dr. History Sage Scholar.
Woo-hoo.
Moral dominatrix. Yes.
I will punish you with the power of my whip of morality. Ka-cha! Every single time Dr. Moral History Scholar like is mad at me for making a sex joke, I just assume he's hitting me on the ass with a whip, and I like it.
Today we've got the
50 Shades of Gay.
This day in history as well.
So on August 4th, 1964, the second Gulf of Tonkin incident occurs off the coast of Vietnam.
There were two?
Yes.
There were two? Yeah, I didn't know that. Yeah, there were two.
I thought just the one was bad, and that's what happened. Okay. No,
the sequel wasn't better.
This incident...
You drew first blood, but like a second time.
This incident, of which there were so many conflicting reports, escalated American involvement in Vietnam. The resolution that bears its name was passed 6 days later on a vote of 416-0 in the House of Representatives and 88...
No opposition.
None in the House of Representatives.
Wow.
And 88-2 in the Senate.
88-2.
Who are the two?
Yeah.
I forget who they were, but one of them was more or less of the, like... Are you sure that actually happened? And the other one is, I think, had a very different reason for opposing it. But yeah, no, it was 416-0 in the House.
I mean, the Cold War consensus at that time was just like...
Well, I mean, yeah, there's that, and then you have the fact that Americans didn't... It was inconceivable to Americans in 1964 that their government would lie to them about such a thing.
Yeah.
It's quaint.
It's crazy.
They were like, of course, yeah, you know.
We're the best.
Yeah, Lyndon Johnson's a good dude.
Well, in people's defense, yeah, right? Like, their government had literally, like, helped destroy the greatest evil of the Nazis, 20th century. Yeah. Like, and so it's like, we came out of World War II, and not only did we do that, but we also, I mean, you know it better than I do, Dr. History, but, like, the... It's like they call it the manufacturing miracle of World War II. Like, the way the U.S. was able to industrialize, not just to, like, fight our own war, but to support the Allies, the Soviet Union, British, everybody else included. Like, there was this great... Dan Carlin did it again. I've talked about him, like, three times today. But he did this great speech by Franklin Roosevelt that was, like, kind of after the Japanese had already started taking... like, I think parts of the Philippines and things, but he basically thought, like, he came out and basically said, like, "Dear America," you know, he did his Franklin, but "Dear America, I have a cigarette in my teeth, so I have to,"
and I'm constantly smiling.
I'm constantly smiling. It's not because of the pain from the polio.
Get your vaccines, people.
But he basically said, like, the leaders of Germany and Japan think that we're a nation of playboys, like a nation of rich people who would pay other people to do our fighting for us. And you could feel every single American man being like, "I will fucking fight those guys, fuck them." Some guy in Texas is like, "Who said what about what? I'll fucking come out there. I don't know where Okinawa is, but I'll fucking fight there." You know what I mean?
There's nothing like challenging their manhood to get America going.
Oh, I mean, whatever. You know what I mean? This is, you know, that's how we do. That is how we do.
Yeah, so speaking of American manhood, we're going to finish up the
paragon of American manhood.
We're going to finish up...
Hulk Hogan?
Retching noises.
Dr. History didn't like that at all. He's like, "Oh, would you like... Who is the quintessential American man? The guy who walked the walk and talked the talk and went to the West and charged San Juan Hill and lived his life for a dedication of honor? Or
Hulk Hogan?
A steroid..." Steroid pump.
Macho Man Randy Savage.
Oh, yeah. That is America. You would love to deny it, Dr. History, but what's more America? Teddy Roosevelt or WCW?
Or snapping into a Slim Jim.
Snapping into a Slim Jim is under the WCW umbrella.
See, I'd say it's you know, it's the... You don't have to choose. It's
I feel like it's...
Yes.
It's like a Kevin Bacon, like, no, 3 degrees of separation.
No, it's the... you'd say the opposite ends of the same coin kind of thing.
Yeah.
Right? It's the there's the quote of, like, the difference between a good man and a bad man is a choice of causes.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, that's the kind of thing that it is. No. Right? It's how do you... How
a
do
good
you,
American, a bad American.
Yeah, American, like, how do you... How do, yeah, how do you... How do you... how do you... How do you channel that sort of thing rather than just...
Through the Erie Canal.
The Panama Canal.
That one too. That one was a little bit more problematic. Now some jazz.
So part three, the crowded hour.
Ooh.
So on June 30th...
He finally got over that hour.
Yeah, we're getting to it. We haven't gotten to it yet.
We haven't gotten to it yet. It hasn't been crowded. It's only been slightly stuffy. It's
slightly congested.
It's been a slightly congested month. We're getting to the crowded hour. So on June 30th, the day that the Rough Riders...
Wait until you get to the overpopulated minute.
Well, no, that's the unforgiving minute. Oh. That's a poem from... what's his name? The guy who coined...
Hulk Hogan.
No.
Quick, let me rip my shirt off.
It's the British, like, jingoistic...
Lord Pope.
No, he was in, like, the late...
Lord Mountbatten. Lord...
I'll come back
Winchester
to it.
Winchester Fieldman.
So,
Robert Frost.
No, he's American.
How dare you?
I know.
How dare you not know Robert Frost is American?
The guy who wrote the Jungle Book.
Oh,
Upton Sinclair.
Rudyard Kipling.
Kipling wrote a poem, The Unforgiving Minute. Oh. Right. Yeah. So anyway, so on June 30th, the day that the Rough Riders,
I'll cut that out.
The day that the Rough Riders began their march from Las Guasimas towards Santiago, Roosevelt was promoted to Colonel of Volunteers and officially put in charge of the 1st Volunteer Cavalry. Mm. So you're asking, is he actually the boss? Now he is.
Oh,
because Leonard Wood, who had been his old commander, was promoted to Brigadier General. So Leonard Wood is now commanding the brigade. Roosevelt is now commanding the regiment. So on they marched, 3 miles through dense jungle. This hike that should take somewhere about, like, to walk 3 miles would take about somewhere between an hour and 90 minutes. Yeah. You could probably walk. Normally. It took them nearly 8 hours.
Yeah, have you ever walked through a jungle?
Absolutely not. Yeah. I imagine it would be
It's a real motherfucker. Yeah. There's a lot of shit in the way, like trees and vines and plants and rivers. The funniest thing, too, about a jungle is, like, let's say you walk in a straight fucking line. Like, which is more or less impossible because there's trees and whatnot.
Let's say
you walk in a straight line and you look at a map and you're like, this looks like just a green area, right? Yeah. It's just green. And then all of a sudden you'll get to like a river that wasn't there.
On the map.
Yeah, like not on the map at all. It might not have been there 2 months ago, but it's like 4 or 5 people wide. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Yeah. Just flowing and you're like, do we just go? Like, what do we do now? Like, people don't understand the fucking rainy season in America. The rainy season is bananas.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, there's just rivers in places there weren't rivers, and they will just take trucks and just have those trucks just float on down away into nowhere. Yeah.
And weren't they suffering from, like, yellow fever?
Not yet. That's going to be an issue later. So once they marched through this jungle for 8 hours, once they were in position, they could see the heights of San Juan, the last obstacle between the American army and Santiago de Cuba. They were to attack and take the hills the next day, July 1st, 1898. So the battle that comes down to us as San Juan Hill was not an elegant affair. The Spanish had fortified Kettle Hill and Kettle Hill's companion, which is San Juan Hill, with blockhouses, bunkers, and trenches. And even though these heights commanded the approaches to Santiago, and the Spanish had a garrison of nearly 15,000 in and around the city, only 550 men were posted to defend these hills.
Was it because they were easily defendable?
I think that's part of it. I think also the Spanish army in Cuba has been fighting a insurgency for the last 3 years and is probably exhausted. Yeah, they're just not in good shape. Also, you get the feeling get the feeling that the Spanish army might be relatively, at least its commanding officers might be relatively incompetent.
But when has an imperial power ever had incompetent officers? When has that ever?
All the time.
Most of the time.
Yeah. So opposing this forlorn garrison was nearly 8,500 men, a ratio of roughly 16 to 1. So the U.S. outnumbers the Spanish on the San Juan Heights 16 to 1.
Wow.
I say it is not elegant since the American assault was not well coordinated. Because of this, American troops sat under punishing Spanish artillery fire for hours waiting for the orders to attack. As shells and shrapnel rained down on the Rough Riders, TR rode his horse up and down the line encouraging the men.
For six hours?
Hours.
It's tough with the difference in terrain. Them having the high ground.
Yeah, exactly.
It makes a big difference.
It does.
I can't vacuum for an hour without being tired. I'm like, this fucking sucks. I'm done. I don't want to do this anymore. No one's shooting at me or anything.
And so while men died or were gravely wounded around him, Roosevelt remained untouched, but for a nick on the wrist from some shrapnel. So like a piece of shrapnel flies by and hits him on the wrist. TR and his men.
Oh, my jerk off hand.
TR and his men waited opposite Kettle Hill.
He hated that so much. It's like, TR has never jerked off once in his life. I'm going to tell you a little secret, Dr. History. At least once he jerked off. And I want you to picture it.
He's like, no!
So So finally, at about 1 p.m., Roosevelt was ordered forward, as were the regulars, in particular the 9th Cavalry, which is one of the African-American Buffalo Soldier regiments.
Okay.
The officers of the 9th, who are mostly...
So they volunteered, the Buffalo Soldiers?
Yeah, they're part of the regular army. All the entire army is volunteers. There are no draft. There's no draft for the Spanish-American War. Every soldier in it is a volunteer.
Okay.
Which is part of the reason why the army's not that big.
Okay.
Right? So the officers of the 9th, who are almost all white, refused to move. So the officers of the 9th Cavalry are like, we're not going anywhere.
Why?
Because they're under artillery fire. They don't think the plan is working. It's unclear, honestly.
Okay, all right.
Roosevelt, infuriated, ordered his regiment to pass through the regulars to the hill. He's like, if you're not going to get out of the way, we're going.
And he's like, also, by the way, I order you to give them all the middle finger as you go by. Like, your hands reached out, just like, fuck you, brother.
So the younger officers of the 9th, as well as the men in the ranks, their professional pride wounded by the sight of mere amateurs moving to the sound of the guns, followed Roosevelt. Nice. So the 9th is like, screw this, we're going with.
Can I just repeat last episode, or two episodes ago, better to ask for forgiveness than permission.
So up the hill they went, Roosevelt the only man on horseback and the most senior officer on the field.
No shit. He was the only guy on a horse?
Yep.
Wow. So that means every asshole with a rifle on the top of the hill was like, get that guy!
And they couldn't.
Like, oh my
God. Apparently God owed him a favor. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Or the Spanish were basically stormtroopers from Star Wars.
Pew, 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 pew. So at this point... So at this point, depending on how we count and how we count who is actually engaged, Roosevelt is the de facto commander of somewhere between 2,000 and 5,000 men.
Nice.
Right? Because like certain regiments don't actually get involved, but they might be there. So it depends on how you count them. Quote, I was not acting in accordance with orders. I have been told to support the attack of the regulars. I gave the order to charge and led in person that portion of the line on horseback, end quote. That is Roosevelt himself saying that.
If there's anything that's more supportive of an attack, it's to order the attack. That's like, I support this attack by charge! Let's go!
So the Rough Riders and the regulars suffered heavy losses. The volunteers in their brown and the regulars in blue. About halfway up the hill, Roosevelt decides to dismount. He's like, it's getting a little hairy.
Slap that horse on the ass. Get out of here.
Well, and apparently the Mauser bullets made a sound that soldiers described as like the ripping of cloth as they whizzed by you.
Oh, that makes sense. Like,
so, yep. Yeah, yeah. And so he's like, nope. But he was still out in front with a blue polka-dotted handkerchief tucked into his hat so that his men could see him, right? So he's still out in front, and he's got this big scarf, this big bandana tied around his neck so his men can see him.
Polka dots. So it's like hit here or here or shoot here or here. Any of them will work. Hit any of the dots and it'll be fine.
Hit any of the space in between the dots and it will be fine. Wow. Quote, he goes on to say, quote, being the first man on the hill and killing a Spaniard.
So the worst was him getting hit on the wrist.
Yes.
He doesn't the whole get time.
Yes. So Jesus. He goes on to say, quote, being the first man on the hill and killing a Spaniard with my own hands, I led in person the next charge on the second line of blockhouses.
So he did kill.
He shoots a Spanish soldier with his revolver. Mm. They had taken Kettle Hill, but Roosevelt spied San Juan. He ordered, again without any authorization from anyone else, a charge on San Juan Hill.
I like it.
But like when he called the charge, he made it about 100 yards before realizing he's alone.
Everybody, let's just dance. And then he dances for a while and looks around like, oh shit, well, I'm out in this dance.
So by myself. In the din of battle, the men had not heard him. So he goes back, got his men, and charged San Juan Hill. Again, part two. Let's try it again.
So listen, guys.
This time with feeling.
So listen, guys. The first time it didn't really work out that good. But this time we really got it. You know? Yeah.
So, quote, I led in person the third charge, and then at the extreme front commanded the fragments of 6 cavalry regiments and brigades until the next morning, end quote. By 4:30 p.m., it was all over. In 3.5 hours, Roosevelt had helped open the way to Santiago. Roosevelt would say of his experience, quote, "As I gave the order to charge San Juan Hill, there slipped through my mind Alfred Thayer Mahan's account of Nelson's orders. I ordered the charge on my own hook," end quote.
Repeat that. I ordered the charge on my own hook?
Yeah, so basically, so what he's referring to, I have to imagine, is we talked about this in the John Paul Jones episodes, that Nelson is where we get the term turn a blind eye.
Right.
At the Battle of Copenhagen, Nelson orders the attack on his own, right, and goes, "I'll take the blame if things go wrong." And Mahan had written a biography of Admiral Nelson that was very influential at the time, and he read his best friend's book and went, and apparently has the presence of mind while being shot at with Mauser rifles to be like, "This is just like that time Nelson took Copenhagen," and goes on.
It's such a, like, aristocratic
thing. I know. I love the high and low, like, the high culture, low culture, like, combo of, like, Roosevelt.
Yeah.
Like, and this was just, it was poetic. It made me
bang, bang, bang.
Yeah. No, the grace of shooting that Spaniard in the face. I was so inspired. I thought of Shakespeare at that moment.
Because this is not like a new thing in history. I remember this really interesting, I think it was Plutarch wrote about Caesar, and that Caesar like wept at the statue of Alexander because like he was younger than me and he already conquered almost the known world. Why am I such a piece of shit? And you're like, worry about your own life, dude. Like, it's fine. And he's doing the same thing. He's like, I read this shit in this book, and like literally zoom, 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 like bullets are going past his head, and he's just like, wait, but am I as cool as Admiral Nelson? Like, oh my God,
dude, live in the moment, okay?
Right. Live, laugh, love, Roosevelt. Jesus.
Live, laugh, shoot that Spanish guy.
Right between the eyes. Pa-pow.
So while the assault had been successful, it had been a bloodbath. U.S. losses were 10% dead, which is about 205 men.
Un baño de sangre.
See.
Bloodbath. That's a bloodbath.
And 11% wounded.
Bloody hands.
So they suffered about 20% losses taking the heights. The Rough Riders had suffered 86 dead and wounded, 6 missing, and 40 more were sick. So while Spanish troops attempted to reinforce Santiago for another stand, Theodore Roosevelt was recommended for the Medal of Honor.
Ooh, that's a good one. That's one of the good ones.
On July 4th, the Spanish Caribbean squadron was destroyed attempting to break out of Santiago. Without naval support, the Spanish troops in the city were now under siege. That siege would last until July 17th, when the Spanish garrison surrendered on the condition that the entire force on the island, some 23,500 men, could return home to Spain.
That's a lot of people.
Yeah, so the Spanish go, "We'll surrender as long as we have safe contact to go home."
And that's the end of the war?
More or less. Yeah. Like, functionally, this is the end of the war, right? It will take a couple of months.
The Philippines is a little
already done, right? Like,
it was already done.
Oh, yeah, because of Roosevelt's orders, Dewey attacks Manila Bay like the day after the declaration of war happens, destroys the Spanish fleet.
Yeah, and my understanding is basically the Spanish fleet goes down, and like the first American who steps foot in the Philippines, they're like, "We're yours now."
Yep.
Like, it's fine. It's fine. We don't care. Yeah. We don't care.
Okay. Yeah,
so, ¿hablo español? No. Está bien. It's okay. It's okay. We'll figure it out.
So the destruction of the Spanish fleet in
Cuba. We got a few decades to figure it out.
Womp womp. So the Spanish. With the destruction of the Spanish fleet in Cuba, coupled with the destruction of the Spanish fleet in the Philippines, and the captures of both Santiago and Manila, this functionally ends the war. Okay. But without
necesitamos un siesta. We need a little rest now. Let's just take a little.
But without a formal,
put a lot of effort into that.
Without a formal treaty, the army descended into a limbo of malaria and other ailments because they're stuck in Cuba. They can't go home.
Malaria limbo is actually pretty hard because when you have malaria, it's pretty hard to get under the bar. Like, you're like, and you're like, "I have malaria, I'm shitting myself, so I can't get under the bar for limbo." All right, anyway.
So they went back to the city of Daiquiri.
So Roosevelt raged at the incompetence of the Army High Command and the War Department. He had been astounded, proud, and inspired by the virtue and valor of the ordinary soldiers. To now see them die of disease and mismanagement was intolerable. In a letter he wrote to his friend Senator Lodge, who subsequently quoted it on the floor of the Senate, he wrote, quote, our condition is horrible in every respect. I have over 100 men down with fever, out of 400, 200 having previously died or been sent to the rear. Mismanagement of the hospital service has been such that my men will not leave the regiment, yet we have nothing for them but hardtack, bacon, and coffee without sugar. I cannot even get oatmeal and rice except by pain of it myself. I have to buy the men canned tomatoes and tobacco. I feel terribly to see them suffering for lack of plain food, to see my men in high fever lying in the mud on their soggy blankets. My men's shoes are worn through. Two of them went into battle at San Juan Hill barefooted. Their clothes are in tatters, end quote. Now, while these sorts of letters did open the spigots of War Department aid, they did prevent him from receiving the Medal of Honor. Accused of interfering with the conduct of the war and going over the heads of those above him in the chain of command, the Secretary of War, Russell A. Alger, blocked all attempts to award him the medal. He would receive it, but not until 2001.
Oh, wait, so what?
He was awarded the Medal of Honor posthumously.
In 2001?
Yeah,
in
2001. Well, because he stopped those attacks.
Dr. Hitchens College tried real hard not to laugh at that one.
Could you imagine if Teddy Roosevelt's ghost just showed up and was like, you shall not pass.
Going to hell.
Oh, we're right there with you.
Well, that's fair. That's
so, like,
fair.
The worst part was them just hanging out.
Yeah, no, I mean, that was
Santiago.
That was legitimately the U.S. I mean, so, the first war, at least since maybe like the Romans or like the ancient Chinese, the first war in well over 1,000 years where more men are killed by weapons than by disease is the Russo-Japanese War of 1905. Mm-hmm. Like, the American Civil War, normally the estimates of the dead are put at about 700,000 or 750,000. Of those, only, that's a horrifyingly macabre thing to say, only 250,000 of them are killed in battle. The other half million die of disease.
Right. Yeah, they get their leg cut off, but to no avail because they get a fucking infection anyway.
So we're coming to the end here. So the Rough Riders had suffered about 200 dead total.
Sorry to interrupt again, but like I get his, like I get that anger.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Right, where it's like, no, you don't understand. We just like charged this hill. We got shot at. Mm-hmm. We like did this unbelievably brave thing.
But we don't have boots.
Yeah, and now we're dying because mosquitoes exist. Like, what the fuck is wrong with you? Know what I mean? Like,
yeah, we don't. We have nothing to eat. But like, part of this is apparently
there's nothing left behind.
Well, so the issue is the army is
none of them speak Spanish.
It's that doesn't help.
Gordito, por favor.
That doesn't help. But the other part of it is that the army is so poorly managed during the Spanish American War. Like, there are soldiers getting beef that is like canned beef that's like 10 or 15 years old that is like clearly turned that the army doesn't care that it's handing out. God. Right. You know, there's,
you said the term canned beef.
Yep.
I don't think I've ever eaten canned beef. Have either of you ever eaten canned beef?
No, I haven't. There's a reason we don't do it anymore.
Hormel chili is beef in a can. That's enough. True.
Have you ever had the chipped beef on toast?
No.
Or as it's more commonly referred to as a shit on a shingle?
I have not, no.
That's like probably the closest thing you could get to like what they're talking about here, which is you can go to the store and get like it's essentially dehydrated beef. Mm. And my grandfather talked about having it in the Navy and it's disgusting. Yeah. It's apparently very salty. Just the way that it's made, it's just you're like, oh God, it's so much salt.
Yeah, because if you want beef to exist in a can.
Yeah, you need to salt the hell out of it. Salt. Yeah.
Holy shit. Preserve the shit.
Well, they had Tabasco, right?
No.
No, they didn't.
So the Rough Riders.
I can eat basically anything if I have enough Tabasco. Yeah.
So they suffered about 200 dead in the war, with another 123 ill, making their casualties the highest of any unit in the Expeditionary Force. So the Rough Riders suffered more casualties than any other single regiment, which had suffered about 1,600 dead in total. Roosevelt mourned their losses, but his jingoistic way of putting it made him sometimes seem callous to people with anti-war sentiments. So he does, I don't think Roosevelt himself, I think he felt very deeply about the soldiers who died under his command. I do not think that he didn't care. But the way he talks about it sometimes, if you didn't know him personally, you might get the sense.
Out of context.
Out of context, or even without having met him. If you were only reading his words, just the words about the war, and if you already thought the war was a stupid idea. Like, for instance, Mark Twain has almost nothing good to say about Theodore Roosevelt. Right? Because he does, but the way that Roosevelt talks about war, and he'll talk about like the glorious dead, and he means it. He does mean it.
I mean, it puts money where the mouth
exactly, is, but it does. It rubs some people back in the States the wrong way.
Well, especially too. I mean, Japan had the same problem in the early part of the Meiji Restoration when they first started conquering Korea and China. Was just like the. The problem is anyone who dies for your cause is like a valuable soul that you've lost for that cause. And I can see Teddy Roosevelt's like, no, you don't understand. Like, we did this glorious, honorable thing. So I want to, like, how would I say it? Like, rise them up to a point of nobility, to a point of. But if you don't view war sanctify that way, you're just like, oh, you're just talking about, like, just. Pointless dead, right? You're just talking about people who died
and sanctifying cannon fodder.
And I think that, and that's, I think that's a really good point. And it's the difference between, like, for instance, you know, the American Civil War and World War II, right? In comparison to it, right, where you people in both of those conflicts genuinely, very deeply believed that the conflict was just. So hearing those sentiments come out of the mouth of Abraham Lincoln or George Marshall or Franklin Roosevelt don't sound as stilted or as forced because you can
be the mother of five dead fighting Sullivans on a destroyer? Right. And you can be the mother of five dead sons and be like, they died for something greater than me, greater for them, greater for everything. But if you're San Juan Hill for
if
Cuba,
you're Hamilton Fish II and you die in Las Guasimas and if your parents don't think that, you know, having access to more sugar is all that important
or a coaling station
is all that important, it is harder to justify. But again, Roosevelt does think that all of these things are important, and he does think that the, you know, he is honoring the dead.
He was the kind of guy who really had blinders.
Like, he absolutely
like, if he's focused on something, like, he does not see any other options or opinions.
He absolutely does. There is someone who once said that he was a moralist first, last, and always, and not one racked by self-doubt. Right? He never has any self-doubt. He always believes. He taught himself. His father has this effect on him, and he internalizes it, which is Theodore Roosevelt Sr. His dad is also named Theodore Roosevelt. Was like, if you are doing the right thing, the morally right thing, that anyone who opposes you must be wrong. And Roosevelt carries that around with him his entire life. If I believe something, Roosevelt thinks, I must be right, and those who oppose me are not merely misguided, not merely stupid, they might be evil.
So it's like he brings a moral lens to whatever
he absolutely does. But the weird piece of him, is that he still is like an effective politician. Moralizing is not normally the province of when I say effective politician, I mean like getting things done. The ability to like go and compromise you know, do the horse trading doesn't seem like the province of someone who moralizes. But even there, he's going, I'm doing it because my objectives are
moral.
But he
was never a legislator.
Oh, he was. Remember in New York, he's a legislator in the New York State Assembly. You have to go back and listen to the first episode.
Oh, I forgot about
that.
An administrator.
Normally he spends more time in the executive branch. He likes that. He's more in charge. But even like when you get to the fact that when he's president, he gets a lot of legislation passed. and is a very, he is the most active chief executive since Abraham Lincoln, right? Like all of the presidents between Lincoln and Roosevelt are like, oh, Congress will do it.
Yeah.
Right.
And Roosevelt's forgettable.
Yeah, exactly. And Roosevelt is like, no, no, I'm going to browbeat Congress until they do the things I want them to do. Right? He's the one who coins the term the bully pulpit. Yeah, right? Yeah. Like he's like, I am going to bully Congress into So
that was more international, but I get the whole idea too. And I've often said this, right? But like one of the most destructive forces in like humanity is your ability to rationalize, right? Like every SS soldier rationalized what they were doing the entire time. And and in Teddy Roosevelt's case, it wasn't that bad. Like probably there was some shit he did that like he shouldn't have, that like he rationalized his way out of. But like it just
The difference between a good man and a bad man is a choice of causes.
That's
right?
A very good point.
And it is one of those things that is about Teddy Roosevelt, and especially with his experience, the fact that his only real experience of war, which again, it isn't to say that like seeing a man hit with a Mauser rifle bullet is not going to be pretty, but the fact that his experience of war, his only experience of war is the Spanish-American War.
It's glorious.
It's short. It's very one-sided, right? And the United States, it's other than the Mexican War, it is the only war where, like, clearly the United States gets something really good out of the deal, right? And so the fact that that's his only experience of it, and that it occurs only, like, 3 years too early, right? If the war, if the Spanish-American War had been fought in, like, 1901 or 1902, I think it would have been a very different conflict in terms of the technology, which would have made him have a very different view on what war is like. And so you do have to sort of look askance at him, right? Because he is going to, during World War I, he's going to try to volunteer to fight in World War I. Again, because he is, if Roosevelt had been...
He doesn't understand how different it's going to be.
But if Roosevelt had been elected in 1912, I think there's a very real chance the United States declares war on Germany for invading Belgium, right? Like,
because he would say, how dare they invade Belgium? Yeah, we have a moral...
Exactly. Certainly, if he didn't declare war on Germany for invading Belgium, he would have declared war on them for sinking the Lusitania. Okay. There would have been no like, oh, we're going to write a sternly worded letter to the Kaiser to protesting.
He's like, I do that 5 times a day. I write letters constantly.
When I'm not reading whole books in a single city or practicing jujitsu, right? You know,
I feel like Teddy Roosevelt was like the predecessor to Chuck Norris. Like that was like it was kind of like,
except not a giant douche.
Right? No, not a giant douche, but like.
Norris is a big douche.
I mean, he is a big douche, but it was like the same kind of thing where I was like, I did things hardcore, like Chuck Norris,
Exactly.
Like the whole early internet meme about Chuck Norris
punched a shark or whatever.
Wait, did you guys know that Teddy Roosevelt's tears cure cancer?
Yeah, but he doesn't cry.
Yeah, too bad he doesn't cry.
Like Chuck Norris.
Actually, during the charge of San Juan Hill, Teddy Roosevelt fell in this really big puddle, and the puddle, he didn't get wet. The puddle got Teddy Roosevelt. I bartended for a long time. I've heard a lot of these. Yeah.
So by August 1898, the Rough Riders were home. They go home, and by September they'd all been mustered out. Right. They are now out of the army. In that same month, his men gave him a sculpt of a cowboy riding a bucking bronco, and he loved this.
Yeah, he did.
He kept that in the Oval Office when he becomes president. He's like,
sometimes
this is amazing.
He'd lock the door. No one would be able to go in there for like 15, 20 minutes.
You'd have to use that old shut up.
Come on, wrist. Don't fail me now.
So Roosevelt...
Did he think about the exploratory mission club?
So this statue is always so polished. It's like shiny every time. Like someone just went over it with a rag.
The Budokaki Club.
So Roosevelt.
No, that was a fucking Roosevelt bronze statue Bukkake joke. It deserves a round of applause. It deserves a round of applause.
Roosevelt's name is already being bandied about for the presidency. So what are the lessons learned for this whole three parts. So the United States was lucky that it fought Spain in 1898.
Yeah, and they were bad at it, if I remember correctly.
And not one of the other European powers.
That was convenient.
On paper, Spain should have defeated the United States in that war, on paper. They were better equipped in nearly every category. Their navy is at least on par with the United States, and they had a large empire to draw resources on. Diminished, certainly, from its heyday, but still...
Well, weren't they kind of an ailing...
So that's this is where paper versus actually...
Institutional reality, you might call it. Because the Spanish, from my understanding at this point in time, the Spanish Empire was like... It was collapsing on the weight of its own like institutional bullshit. Like it's kind of like
well, and they'd lost most of Latin America. Their two remaining colonies are Puerto Rico, they've got Cuba, and they have the Philippines, and they maybe have a couple of other small places. They have some parts of North Africa, but like the real sort of cash cows had been Peru and Mexico and that sort of thing. The other part of it is that Spain had never really it is interesting to think about what was the effect of the Napoleonic Wars on Spain, because basically you had 6 straight years of armies marching all over Spain, burning everything to the ground and massacring people, an insurgency, right? Like the term guerrilla comes from the Spanish fighting the French in Spain from 1808 to 1814, right? And the fact that it did so much damage to the prestige of the Spanish monarchy because the monarchy flees abroad, right? There's that doesn't help. There's the fact that you have, there are liberals in Spain who want Spain to reform, democratize and look maybe not fully democratize, but look more like Britain or the United States. Yeah. And then you have hardcore reactionaries who are keeping that at bay, and that doesn't help. So
that kind of like internal struggle.
Exactly. So I believe that they lost the war for 3 reasons. The first is exhaustion. Spanish troops, especially in Cuba, had been fighting rebels for the better part of 30 years.
Wow.
The garrison in the Philippines had been fighting since at least 1895, when the Filipinos rose up after the example of Cuba. So in both Cuba and the Philippines, there are insurgencies already happening, and the Spanish troops who are there have been fighting them for at least 3 years.
I mean, when you're out there that far away without any support, I mean, it's easy for a local insurgency to win if they're united.
Exactly. And on top of that, fighting an insurgency is very different from fighting a conventional war. Yeah. They require a different set of skills. And so, for instance...
Specific set of skills.
Yes.
but they didn't have Liam Neeson.
They didn't. That would have helped.
Liam Neeson. Liam Neeson.
Yeah.
He would have been fine.
So the second thing, to your point, Lax, is geography. That same far-flung empire that could generate resources for Spain also required Spain to spread her forces out literally across the globe.
Yeah.
In Spain in 1898 functionally has 3 fleets. One for the Pacific, based in Manila, one for the Atlantic, based in Cuba, and a home fleet. With 2 of those 3 destroyed, the Spanish had to negotiate lest they lose that last fleet. Like, if you roll those dice, if you send the home fleet across and it's destroyed...
Yeah. You now have no fleets.
Yeah,
and British are going to be like,
we're going to eat your lunch.
Looks exactly. Good. Yeah, yeah.
So America, by contrast, held a central position, able to project power in both directions towards the Philippines and Cuba as circumstances
America
dictate.
Really, like, the geographical advantage of America is, in the world.
Oh, it is a very... you have 2 oceans and you have the 2 best neighbors.
Yeah.
Right. When you think about in the history of great powers,
the only great power who's had better neighbors than America is Britain, because it doesn't have any.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. Well, we have 0 neighbors, which is good for us.
Yeah. Well, and that's one of the things, hearkening back to the first episode, is in Alfred Thayer Mahan's book, The Influence of Sea Power Upon History, he complains that it's not fair that Britain's an island, right? They don't ever have to spend money on an army. They can spend all of their money. He's saying this is the difference between them and France, is France is always, he's saying fighting. France is always seduced by the idea of having a large army to go conquer Europe.
By seduced, do you mean like there's a bunch of pissed off Germans?
Yeah,
like next door. Yeah. Yeah, that's seduced. Seduced by the fear of Germany.
so we've got exhaustion.
The Prussians or whatever the fuck.
Yeah, so we have exhaustion, we have geography. And then I think the last one, and this is the least tangible, but I do think it it matters, is unvarnished American nationalism. Mm. And what I mean by that is American troops were able to withstand punishing casualties and keep fighting. Mm. A vision of this will be seen again in World War I and World War II, where American troops will take horrifying losses by comparison to comparable nations and continue fighting, mm. right? And I think a large part of that is, you know, the fact that, you know, the average American soldier who went to Cuba is like, you know, America, fuck yeah, kind of thing.
America, fuck yeah.
Yeah, basically.
But, like, there's such a tiny, like...
But it's not a tiny percentage of the American population in 1898. Like, it wasn't a large army because the war didn't last long enough for us to ask for more volunteers.
To, like, mobilize people.
But, I mean, think about even going back to the Civil War, American nationalism... plays, you know, the Union Army, the United States Army, by the end of the Civil War, had enlisted about somewhere around 2.2 million men. Mm-hmm. Of those 2.2 million men, 92% of them volunteered. Mm. Only 8% were drafted. And in the Confederacy, it's a similar story. The Confederacy has its own version of this kind of nationalism. They raise an army of somewhere, it's harder to figure out, somewhere between 750...
Because they couldn't read or write.
Yeah. No, it's because all of their stuff gets destroyed. Yeah, yeah. So it's somewhere between 750,000 and a million men are enlisted in the Confederate Army, and about 80 to 85% of them are volunteers.
Yeah.
So when you consider that is the same cultural, you know, that Americans are swimming in 1898, I think even if the war had gone on longer, it would have taken the destruction of multiple expeditionary forces before the United States would have to resort to a draft. In the same way that in World War I, the British... during World War I, the British will end up with an army, will end up enlisting 5 million men in their army in World War I. The first half are all volunteers. Yeah. Britain doesn't institute conscription until 1916.
Mm.
After it's enlisted 2.5 million men.
Killed like a shit ton of
men. And the Battle of the Somme happens, and 50,000 men are killed in a day, right? Yeah. You know, and so, but that is, you know, nationalism has that effect, and it is... It is the fact, I think, very, very clearly the fact that Spanish troops are not nearly as motivated to, like, die for king and country the way that American troops are motivated to die for
the real question is, like, okay, so Civil War makes sense. Like, the North is fighting, at first.
For Union.
For Union. Which and then it became about liberation.
Yeah, like, yeah, okay, both of those things are true.
But initially it was for the Union, but then it became for liberation of the slaves. And Confederacy was fighting for state rights,
well, they were,
quote,
they,
unquote, white supremacy, whatever.
Yeah.
But, like, the War of 18... whatever, the Spanish-American...
American War, yeah, the Spanish-American War.
War of 1898 was, like, remember the Maine...
Well, look at what we did after two of our towers got blown up by commercial aircrafts. Well, like, so how many millions of people died because we were like, fuck you! And the other thing, too, is that I think, and for better or for worse, because I think generally it's better, but sometimes it's worse, that... A country like the U.S., and especially pre-World War II, right? And again, to our listeners, I am separating out our wars of, like, Western conquest, right? Because that was just... It was just a different thing. That was the government and a bunch of corporations essentially sending troops into a place to pacify areas so we could set up gold mines and stuff.
Yeah.
It was just, you know, your classical capitalism, right? But if we're talking about the Spanish-American War, the Civil War, World War I, World War II... Americans, and I think this is true for a lot of democratic societies, is we're like the quiet kid in class you don't want to fuck with a little bit. You know what I mean? Like, the bullies run around and they fucking talk a lot of shit and they run their mouth or whatever. But, like, and again, pre-World War II, America was that country, and even Japan said that, to awaken the sleeping giant. We were the ones who were like, nope, fuck you guys. and your stupid bullshit. We don't care about the League of Nations. We don't care about European wars. We don't care. Go fight. Go fight. Go fight. We don't care. But the second we take it personal, like it's actually us, it's the Lusitania went down or Germany fucking declares war, Japan bombs Pearl Harbor. The second we're just like, oh, no, 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 this is personal now. Like it's like every American action hero, like you made it personal. And now the entire economy is dedicated to crushing you.
And there's also, it's the effect of nationalism. Which is it does not have the same effect on the United States today as it did in 1898. Which is there's a quote from right before World War One. A British army officer is talking to a French army officer, to General Foch, and he asks they're trying to plan how many British troops will be needed by the French in the case that the Germans attack them.
Yeah.
And General Foch goes, and this British officer goes, what's the minimum number of British soldiers you would need? And Foch goes, one, and we'll be sure to get him killed.
Yeah,
the idea being that like now you've got skin in the game.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If a British soldier is killed by German soldiers, then Britain is going to... And Americans in 1898 were very convinced that Spain had blown up the Maine. We know now that they didn't. But the people at the time were very convinced that Spain had cold-bloodedly murdered 75% of the Maine's crew.
It also was kind of a pretext.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, obviously, you know, the whole idea of having coaling stations throughout the world to project power.
Sugar production.
All that stuff. And also, like, you know, in the background.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, Smedley Butler wrote a fucking book about the period after this, up until World War I, where it was like, hey, you know all these, like, countries that exist in the Western Hemisphere? That one's ours, and that one's ours, and Dole Fruit owns that one, and Dole Fruit,
And now you're having to distinguish between what did a person on the street think and what did a person
Washington
Club.
Roosevelt, who was up there.
Yeah, Roosevelt is thinking in terms of coaling stations. He's thinking in terms of... He's also thinking in longer terms, which is that he believes that Spain is going to lose Cuba eventually anyway.
Mm-hmm. And so why wouldn't you have them as a friend?
Well, and not just that. It should be America that pushes Spain out of Cuba. Because what if the Germans... What if the Germans are the ones who push them out? Yeah, and now the Germans hold, you know, Guantanamo Bay, right? There's a German naval base at Guantanamo Bay, and Roosevelt would find that very...
He would go himself to Guantanamo Bay.
Das ist schon empanada.
He spoke German.
I'm getting my gloves, and I'm going to go fight them myself.
I challenge the Kaiser in his gimpy left arm.
Roosevelt would have fed him his own gimpy left arm. He would have had that gimpy left arm down the Kaiser's throat and be like, or he'd have it in his hand and he'd be hitting the Kaiser with it and be like, stop hitting yourself, stop hitting yourself. The Kaiser's weird little fucking arm. Fuck the Kaiser. That is a strong laughing historical point.
Yes. On that note. That should be recorded.
Luckily.
That. And I think that's been our episode. Any other parting words? Thoughts?
Oh, did we do lessons learned?
Yeah, he did lessons.
You did lessons learned. Did you do a lesson learned?
I have no.
I think
imperialism. You know,
bad.
So I took the opposite.
There's the heel turn. Putin's life.
No. Imperialism is good so long as Teddy Roosevelt specifically is doing it.
As long
anyone
as
else is
he's
bad.
He's leading the charge.
Like, you don't understand. I was in the West, and I was in the West, and like, I punched a man in the face. Therefore, my imperialism is better than your imperialism.
I feel like Teddy was hoping he could go to the Philippines as well.
No.
To like,
I have a little bit of an Asian fetish.
I really want that yellow fever.
Domo Irigato, Mr. Roosevelt. Dr. Hitchin Scott is hanging his head in shame. Hanging his head in shame.
He's like, hold on for me, Captain Lodge. Hold it on for me, man.
Hey there, Captain Lodge. Have you ever been to the Philippines? I hear the girls are swinging. I don't know if they said that at the time. They do the Charleston on their backs.
Roosevelt is rolling over in his grave.
Yeah, that's fine.
He was a bit of a prude.
He was Victorian.
Yeah, that's what he was on the outside.
It's like, show me an ankle or something like that.
I'm just saying, show me his Google history and we'll see how prude he is. All right.
That's been our episode. Follow us on Instagram, laughing hist, leave us a comment, feedback, questions, Dr. Hist Scholar moral superiority complex is dying for a question.
No, and actually,
he's been staying up late.
It's an interesting note you say that, because if you've ever seen Back to the Future,
yeah,
you know when he's looking at the photo and his family's slowly evaporating into nothingness because of the time-space continuum, that's what's happening to Dr. History Scholar when you don't ask him questions. Every time you ask him a question, he comes back into reality, and they're like, and he plays electric guitar in front of a bunch of weird people. If you don't do that, he's just going to evaporate from history.
So please leave a question or a comment.
1.21 gigawatts of questions.
Paul, Will, Zach, Frank,
John, Joseph, Luke,
Jingleheimer Schmidt.
I was doing apostles, but I get where you guys are coming from.
Joseph wasn't.
Did I say Joseph?
Yeah.
Oh, it's just my Mormon cousin's name, Joseph, so I assumed.
He's the stepfather.
And that's been our show. Thank you so much.
Love historically, 5 stars.